This is episode 82 of the Fifth Estate podcast. Carol Roth, the business person with an action figure. It is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am flying solo again this week. Co-host Amy Otto, I think, is on vacation. She's off playing in the volcanoes of Hawaii or something like that. Or, that's where I saw pictures on Twitter is where she is. So it's just me this week. Nothing has changed. As always, ask you, our fine audience, if you like this show, if you like this podcast, so please go out to iTunes, open up iTunes on your computer, on your Mac, on your PC. Leave us a review. Leave us a rating. We appreciate it. When Donald Trump ran for president in 2000, when he started his run for president in 2015, there were a lot of people that jumped on board saying, he's a businessman, and why don't we let a businessman run the country? And so, if you look at what's been going on, whether you credit him or not, after a first year, things are pretty good. The stock market is good. Unemployment is low. GDP is growing pretty well. Our taxes are lower now. So there's some good stuff there. We'll get into this with our guest to kind of determine whether or not, what she thinks about it.
But first, we're going to bring you a quick word from our sponsor. All right, we got to talk about man crates. Guys, listen up. If you haven't figured it out yet or have not yet been told by your spouse, significant other, or family member, you're impossible to buy a gift for. But relax, it's all about to change. Introducing mancrates.com, the ultimate place to find awesome gifts guys actually love, guaranteed. Maybe you've got a birthday coming up, or maybe you're looking for a unique way to say thanks to a friend, that buddy who helped you out with moving for the eighth time. If so, man crates has gifts for every type of guy. The coolest part, it's shipped in a solid wood crate with a crowbar so you get to pry it open yourself. Man Crates has hundreds of gift options, so finding that perfect man crate is simple. Just go to mancrates.com/fifth and find unique gifts like the adventurous knife-making kit or the hands-on guy for the hands-on guy or the whiskey appreciation crate for those who like to keep it classy. They have thousands of five-star reviews, and every man crate comes with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. I got a personalized knife from Man Crates, and it's really great. It's a well-made knife. I use it all the time. It's got my initials on it. It's pretty cool. They have awesome stuff, so you have to check it out. So tell your wife, your girlfriend, your mom, whoever you know will be shopping for you soon about Man Crates. And right now, if you go there right now, you'll get 5% off mancrates.com/fifth. It's a limited time offer. You get 5% off right now if you go to mancrates.com/fifth. That's F-I-F-T-H. mancrates.com/fifth.
So wanted to talk about that, but also wanted to talk about some business leadership and everything. And who would be better than to have a guest who's like done it all? Now, I'm not even going to go through her entire biography. If you go to carolroth.com and go to the About section, you can kind of see all the business experience that she has. She's an entrepreneur. She's worked in the finance industry. Even if you follow her on Twitter, which you should, and we'll have all those links in the description, you see that she'll do like these little kind of like little videos, these motivational videos that are really good. It's great stuff. And one of the things that, and we'll get into this in a second, because it's funny, I never talked to her about this, but there was, and we'll kind of go into a little bit more detail. I'll read it off. There's always this thing about the Twitter pawning or owning or something like that. You see that a lot nowadays, but this goes back, almost 5 or 6 years. And she had a tweet exchange with Piers Morgan where it was like one of those things where it was like, you talk about a mic drop moment. That's what it was. And we'll kind of detail a little bit more. But I want to welcome Carol Roth to the Fifth Estate. Carol, thanks for being here.
Jay, it's so great to be here. And I would never think that, like you said, 5.5 years later, I'd still be talking about a Muskets tweet. But it is the gift that keeps on giving. So I will happily talk about it again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because Piers Morgan is one of these, you know, he's not an American. So, and I don't mean that in an insulting sense. Oh, he's not in America. I just mean that he doesn't understand the culture of, you know, America in some respects. And he doesn't understand, you know, what we as people in the United States feel about the American.
We beat them. He's British and we beat them and he's still bitter about it. And he just cannot get past that. And that's really basically what underlies this whole thing.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I have British friends who joke. They say, you know, well, you know, on July 4th, you know, they're like, oh, you know what we refer to July 4th as or what? And they're like, Losers Day. Because they understand, they know. So just here, let me set the table for this. So this goes, it was December 3rd, 2012. And Piers Morgan says, the Second Amendment was devised with muskets in mind, not high-powered handguns and assault rifles. Fact. Carroll replied to him, said it was devised for people to be able to protect themselves with the same type of weaponry used by those from whom they might need protection. And Piers responded, where exactly does it say that in the Constitution? I must have missed it. And Carroll hit him back with right next to the word muskets. And it was just like, it was great. And he tried responding after that. And it was just like, okay, that's one of those things. Like, pick yourself up.
18 hours later.
Yeah.
It took him 18 hours to craft a response. And it was so funny. I remember that day so well because Piers and I actually have been friends for a long time. And I was a regular on a show when he had it on CNN. And that's why he sort of entertained me in this discussion. And I was just trying to be helpful. You know, I was just trying to explain it to him. But when he backed me in the corner with the, well, where does it say that in the Constitution? I must have missed that. I just immediately said, oh, yeah, right next to the word muskets. And I had a business meeting that day. So I just kind of fired that into Twitter and got up and left. And I called one of my friends on the way to my meeting and I said, oh, I'm so funny. Let me tell you how funny I am. Ha ha ha. Which I do actually quite often, but whatever, this tweet. I come back from my meeting and this thing had gone around the universe and I did not get anything done for like the next 3 days between emails and tweets and all of the hoopla. And then the crazy thing is because he continues to open his mouth and say the same things, that it just keeps going around again. And so new people sort of discover this. There was a thing, a big thread on Reddit with, you know, 10,000 or whatever people who were talking about it. And, you know, someone I knew said, hey, did you know you're in the middle of this Reddit discussion? And then let me guess, muskets. And, you know, they had found it. So it's one of those things. It's an evergreen tweet. And it's the gift that keeps on giving.
It was quite a moment. And again, it was, you know, believe it or not, 2012, Twitter still wasn't at the kind of level it has now. I mean, I'm looking at it now. It was like retweeted 684 times. But a lot of people were still doing manual retweets back then.
They screen grab what they did is they screen grabbed the four together because you couldn't just retweet the one tweet. So whoever did the pictures of the tweets, those things got retweeted hundreds of thousands of
times.
But they didn't actually come back to the tweet because you had to see the full four thing exchange.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying. It is deceiving to see that when it's only 684 retweets, but it was just like you said, the screenshots just all over the place. I mean, in fact, last time I talked about it, I think I did the screenshot simply because it was like, you're right, because when you see that one tweet stand by itself, it doesn't really make much sense. You follow the conversation back and all of a sudden you're like, okay, that's what it is.
Well, the best part about it is that it ended up like in all of the gun manufacturers' offices and it was featured in NRA magazine. And so I became the first person to be featured in both Dolls magazine and NRA magazine. So really, I've completely spanned the entire spectrum.
All right. Let's see. There you go. All right. So let's talk a little bit about your background, but some of the stuff that you do. I mean, you are, you know, if somebody wants to sit there and be motivated in their work, especially in the business, and, you know, following you, you know, would be a perfect way to do that. Because you have, you know, again, I talked about these, just these little videos you put out on Twitter that are inspirational things that you talk about, you know, I mean, one of the ones that I saw was, which I really liked, was your, the way that you said you respond to email, that, you know, you kind of do all your replies at the end of the day. You know, you don't sit there and respond to email throughout the day. You kind of get everything together. And then at the end of the day is when you kind of just kind of like fire them off.
Yeah, and then I use the delayed delivery feature a lot right. of times, so that I'll send them out the next morning.
Exactly.
So that people aren't responding back to me in the middle of the night.
Correct. Correct. And, you know, so things like that, you know, kind of just tell us how you, you know, when throughout your work, what are some of the things I'm trying to be specific here, so I don't want you to have to go down a rabbit hole. But if you were going to if you wake up on a Monday morning and you want to have like a very productive kind of day, what are like three things that you think people should do?
So I'm a big fan of lists. My lists have lists. I have post-it notes all over the place for sub lists. So I'm very much about organizing specific tasks. And I think that it's really important to do the things that are really important first. I think people like to cross things off of their list. So it's really easy to go, oh, I'll answer some emails and I'll send a tweet and do those things. And that's the wrong approach. You want to go and you want to take care of those, you know, harder things to do and get those off your plate. And then you can do some of the more screw around things in the afternoon. So it's really knowing what you're going to do, having a plan to attack them, and then prioritizing them in the right way. And I think that that's the best way to be efficient. And then you can build in the little rewards. You know, if I get these three things done, then I can go screw around on Twitter for 10 minutes. And then you have to have the discipline to get off of Twitter and not go down a rabbit hole and come back and do the next couple of things. But that's sort of my methods and my madness. And I also, if things are really important, I live and die by my calendar. So I will put it on my calendar. And I actually set timers on my phone. Like, I'm that crazy person. So I know, like, okay, I have this next thing at this particular time. And if we sit down for a meeting, I know exactly how much time I've allotted. And once that goes off, you know, we end the meeting and I move on with my day.
Now, for when you talk about lists, there are people, some people advocate, you know, listing out, you know, the important tasks that you need to get done, whereas other people will sit there and actually, like, you know, it's something like pay my credit card, you yep. know, actually be on their list. How do you think the everything from big to little should be on that list?
Everything needs to be on some list, either in your calendar for some future date or on your to-do list for the day or on your long-term to-do list. I think that that's the way that you get it done, but you do have to have those big tasks at the top and you have to order them and you go to one, number one first and you do number two second. And if you find something that's important later in the list, you put a three beside that and you cross that one off before you do pay the credit card bill, but it's got to be somewhere or else it just doesn't get done. So whether it's on the list or in the calendar, put it down, make it a task and do it.
Oh, great. Okay, so all right, so that's kind of like how you'd start your day out. You talked about these rewards, like saying like spend 10 minutes on Twitter or something like that, and you're right, getting into Twitter can be, you know, you can kind of waste a lot of time. In fact, I recently removed there's a Twitter app that I really like called Tweetbot for the iPhone and for the Mac. But what it doesn't do, it doesn't have the same kind of, it doesn't bring everything over from the Twitter API. So I have very kind of strict filtering on my regular Twitter app. So it's like, if a person doesn't have like an avatar, it'll mute those responses. Yeah. It's like, I try to keep it, you know, the responses clean. And so I had to get rid of those from my phone and from my computer. And I found out that I'd be a lot more productive when I don't see every reply, and I'm the kind of person when I see something, I almost want to respond, especially when it's stupid. So like how then, okay. So if you're somebody saying, you know, from a business success or kind of like not even so much a business success, but like personal success, how do you approach your use of social media in your daily life?
So I have a lot of different platforms that I'm on for various reasons, including Twitter. Twitter is my, what I call sort of fun and some business kind of things, but it's my voice. About 90% of what goes on there, I control myself. I do have my social media manager putting out some of those things that I've created, like some of the videos and articles that I've written and those kinds of things interspersed. And I try not to run into those times when she's doing it, but sometimes I forget. As far as Facebook, I have no idea what's going on my Facebook page. I mean, I've set the strategy for it, but I have, you know, somebody today be like, oh, I love that thing that you posted on Facebook today. And I'm like, what did I post on Facebook today? And then once they told me, I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, that was that thing. So I have that just because Facebook is, you know, an important outlet. And then, you know, being in all of the business activities that I'm in, LinkedIn is actually very important. But LinkedIn is great because you only really need to post once every day or day and a half or maybe 2 days to kind of, it just can't take that same volume of information. So again, I sort of split that with my social media manager. So we have sort of a master plan, but like if you want my sort of unfiltered take on stuff, that's usually happening on Twitter.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about, you know, one of the things that has come up, and this is something that's been kind of like this talk has been growing over the last couple of years. In fact, year and a half ago, we had Mike Rowe on the show. And Mike is an advocate for, you know, for people doing skilled jobs, not necessarily college type jobs, but that yes. there are jobs out there that don't require a college degree. I'm of the opinion not everybody is made to go to college. I think
correct.
That we have this thing where this, and I think it started in the 80s, you know, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I just remember it being like, first of all, it was this kind of thing where we, you know, plumbers make damn good money. You know, it's a very good living. But in the 80s, it was like plumbers were like the butt end of jokes in like movies and stuff. If a guy was a plumber, he was this guy that had the crack of his ass kind of sticking out. And he was just kind of stupid and goofy and everything like that. I think it was, you know, you saw it like in the Goonies or something like that. You know, and they couldn't fix anything or do anything. But, you know, they actually, you know, those people make a lot of money, and welders and things of that nature. Where do you stand on that? Are you kind of a supporter of that kind of economy, or are you kind of more, hey, you know what? You know, if you can get a college degree, that's really what you should do.
So first of all, I have to give a shout out to Mike Rowe. He was one of my co-judges on a reality show that I judged called America's Greatest Makers on TBS, and he's an amazing guy. So yay, love Mike Rowe. I'm also the daughter of a union electrician. My father's no longer with us, but for 40 years, he was in Local 134 in Chicago. He woke up at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning. He worked outside on, you know, below zero temperatures on buildings like the Bloomingdale's building at 900 North Michigan, if you're familiar with it. You know, my entire life and the fact that I've been able to be so successful is because my father had a blue collar job. And he was one of the most financially savvy people that I knew. He had a great work ethic. We had, you know, middle of the road, but very nice life. And I think it's incredibly, you know, a very important job. And it's one of the things that has been bothering me, because whether it's, you know, something that's considered blue collar or working with your hands, something like plumbing or, you know, being an electrician, or even something like, you know, being a janitor or a maid, I feel like people in this country are just so absolutely rude about very important jobs that we need in our economy. And your worth isn't tied to your net worth or what you do for a living. And if it's something that you enjoy doing and is important and somebody else finds valuable and you created an exchange there, I don't think there should be any shame in doing any honest or legal job. And I think that, you know, we should remember that everybody is a person, and just because they choose to do something to earn their living doesn't make them any more or less important. So it's something that I think is really important. And I also think that, unfortunately, college in this country has become ridiculous, because the amount that it costs to get a degree vis-a-vis what you learn and then what you can earn after that degree, there are, you know, some people who should definitely get those degrees. You know, I was an investment banker. I needed to have that finance degree in order to do that. But the amount of people who are taking on hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt to make $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 a year, you can never get a return on your investment. So if you're just valuing the education for the sake of education, that's fine. But if you're seeing it as a conduit to actually making a living, that's just stupid. So I think that the entire way we approach our work and our jobs and post-secondary education is just gotten completely tied up in knots. And it's something that we really need to look into and sort of reassess our priorities.
There is a right there in your hometown business called Basecamp with Jason. Yes. Jason Fried is the CEO. And
so
I remember
Jason Fried, just so I can now like drop names for every story that you have. So Jason Fried is a longtime family friend. I grew up with him. His parents were at my bat mitzvah. He lived one cul-de-sac over from me. I know Jason very well.
Good. So now if I ever want to have him as a guest, I'm gonna
yeah, tap into that
network. Yeah. But I remember him saying, you know, and you probably know this, how this works, you know, Basecamp, they have a, you know, they're not a very big company, but they have a very unique way of hiring new people. And Jason had said, he said, I want people that can do the work. He goes, I'm not necessarily concerned whether or not this person has a college degree. He says, I'm glad that my doctor has one. He says, but I don't think that that is something that is absolutely necessary in everyday areas. And I still find it kind of amazing that, you know, you still see companies that have still been locked into this kind of notion where this person over here who's done this kind of work for 15 years, that you're going to go and you're going to hire this other guy who's done it for 2 years because he's got a degree in, you know, communication from a college somewhere.
It's pure laziness. It's the same reason why you end up with, you know, all men on panels or no women on boards of directors or, you know, poorly qualified, but lots of education people and jobs that don't have any experience is because people are lazy. And so they take shortcuts. So they hire people that they know, or they feel that if you went to a school, at least you have some level of vetting. And, you know, this way I can't get in trouble because I can point to these tangible things. And that's it. And it's just pure laziness. And I agree. I would rather have somebody who's got a lot of hustle, you know, who's bootstrapped and made their way through life any day over somebody who's got a couple of fancy letters over their name, who's entitled and, you know, thinks that they should be earning whatever it is because, you know, they showed up for class one day.
Yeah. And just so you know, this is where people start getting down on, you know, it sounds like, you know, we're knocking people that go to college and that's not the case. I mean,
I went to college. I'm really glad that I went to college. I think it's appropriate for people. I just think that it's not the be all end all. And I only think that you should take on as much debt as you would make in your fifth year out of school. So if you are going to make $100,000 5 years out of school, you can take on $100,000 in debt. But if you're going to make 50, you take 50. If it's something that requires like a post-second, like a graduate education, like being a doctor, maybe year seven, but that's it. Otherwise, you're never going to pay it back.
Yeah. I mean, I have a friend of mine who lived in Florida. He's a surgeon and he told me about this is a guy who's been a doctor now for about 13 years. And he still told me about the school loans that he was paying off.
Well, and then he didn't count on Obamacare screwing that whole thing up for him in his calculation, because when he was actually going to be able to pay those back, then, you know, now he's not, you know, getting paid appropriately or whatnot. And so it's going to take him a lot longer.
Oh, yeah. Don't even get me. I wouldn't even want to get him started on that conversation. You know, whenever that came up, you could just start seeing the steam come out of his ears. All right. So let's turn then to the political world.
Should we have a theme song for that? I feel like it needs like its own introduction and theme song. Do, 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 do.
Well, there you go. You could do it, and then we'll just amp it up, and we'll add some sound effects to it. So, you know, you heard me at the top of the show talking about, you know, how, you know, things are going in, you know, with the economy after the first year of President Trump. Now, you know, reading through your Twitter feed, I can't tell, you know, there's the people who can't stand Trump. No, there's nothing he can do is ever going to be good. There's the people who I said something the other day, like I said, oh, I said that he could go into their house, poop on the floor, and they'd put it in a shadow box and hang it on the wall. So there's that. And then there's what, you know, I call the people who are kind of agnostic, who are going to say, look, when he's doing something good, I'm going to give him credit for that. And then if he's just doing something dumb or stupid, I'm going to criticize him on that. Where do you find, if you are you kind of like middle of the road in that area? You're like,
I always am. I consider myself an independent libertarian-ish. I did not vote for Trump. I did not vote for Hillary either.
Me neither.
But I went third party. But listen, I obviously support the president. I want the president to be successful. I want America to be successful. So there are a lot of good things that have happened, and I am happy for them. And I think we need to be realistic about those. And just because you don't like the person who enacted them doesn't make them not valid. But like you said, there are also some things that aren't so great, and I'm going to point those out as well. So I try to keep it 100.
So what about the tax cut package? I mean, I call it a tax cut package because it really wasn't reform. I mean, it wasn't a reform of the system.
Right.
It was really just more. I mean, the big thing was, of course, the corporate tax rate reduction, which I thought was great. And of course, there were the personal rates that went down, but all those brackets still remain. And there really wasn't much reform there. The tax code is not going to shrink as a result of that plan. But what did you kind of think of it, though?
Well, I think it's actually more complicated, and my accountant said to me that every time they do simplification of the tax code, it gives him extra business, so he loves it. but so I'm thrilled that we got some things done. I do think that the corporate tax cut was very important, and I think that that's having benefits. We are, despite people saying, oh, it's only for corporations, and you know the average person's never going to see that. We just saw the labor force participation grow at the largest clip since 1983. So that means disenfranchised people who had dropped out of the workforce are coming back in big numbers. So that to me says, yes, it is getting to everyone. So I think that was a great thing. I like the fact that we got some personal tax relief. I don't like the fact that it's not permanent. Living in Illinois, I do not like the fact that I lost my SALT deductions. And then also, I'm a big small business advocate, and I think the biggest place where Congress failed was in terms of their treatment of small business, particularly service providers. So while I think it is a good thing and I think it will benefit almost everyone, I also have some frustrations that I don't think that it went far enough for the people who create the majority of the jobs and the majority of the sales in this country.
Yeah, I think I've heard that from a number of people, and I thought it was interesting. You know, it was funny though when some of the corporations, you know, started reacting to the reduction by giving out these bonuses, talking about what they were going to invest. You know, and of course, Nancy Pelosi's running around saying crumbs. You know,
it's horrible. We're all going to die from getting bonuses.
You know,
the sky's falling.
And it's like if you the first time that I got a bonus when for work, I was working at Cargill International, and I was working in, you know, when they were, I was doing commodities trading. This is like early 90s. Yeah. The first time I got a bonus, I think it was like $700 or something like that after taxes and everything. And it was a wonderful feeling. This idea that, you know, these people aren't going to care about these bonuses because, you know, it's crumbs in consideration next to like $1 billion in tax relief. It's like, That's the kind of thing where a politician, I think, gets so far removed from the people that they represent that they don't understand what $400 or $500 will mean to a person that they get that's just handed to them.
Yeah, it's honestly all people care about. I mean, I go around this country. I live in the Midwest. I go to places that aren't just New York, L.A., Washington, D.C., and the reality is the only thing that people really, truly care about en masse is what's going on in their pocketbook. And even if it's you know, $10. You know, the fact that there were people who were confused because they were seeing more money in their paycheck and it went up by, you know, $10 or $20. What's this? And this is so exciting. And is it a mistake? That's all. They don't care about Russian collusions and, you know, all these other crazy things that the media and the journalists get into it. They care about real dollars in their pocket. And it doesn't matter what that number is, any extra one that they get to keep, which, by the way, it's not something that's given to them. They get to keep it. They earned it. So just less that they have to give to the government is a great thing. And it's just so frustrating that so many politicians do not understand that, especially when they're supposed to be representing and be of the people.
Yeah, it is kind of frustrating. And you know, again, it's like if they would talk to these people who got these bonuses and see what they, you know, it's like if you could get $500 or $600, if you could use it to buy a new television or even a new washing machine or something like that. I mean, that's a huge deal for some people. It's very easy sometimes, I think, for people to sit there and say, well, I got it. You know, I got repairs on my car, $1,000. OK, right out. You know, here it is. Let me go ahead, do the repairs, pay, and then go home. You know, and for some people, you know, it's not that easy. It's not that easy to come up with $500 or $600 for something to, you know, a one-time expense. So, yeah,
I think a very large percentage of the population doesn't even have that $600 in an emergency fund for those emergencies.
Right.
So that they, like you said, they are living paycheck to paycheck, and to be able to have a little bit more in case something comes up is life changing. It's something that can eliminate stress from people's lives. I mean, it is very impactful.
So, all right. So then let's talk about, we talk about the tax cut, and you know, one other thing that President Trump has been given credit for is kind of undoing a lot of regulations, a lot of business regulations. But one area that President Trump seems to kind of be stuck in a different mode is the idea of trade. And he constantly talks about trade deficits in terms of losing, you know, if we have a trade deficit, he'll say, you know, we're losing $800 billion a year. He sees trade deficits as like a report card, you know, and it's like, if it's a negative, then we're doing bad. He doesn't talk very much about the $300 billion service, you know, the trade service that we have. But he's always talking about the negative, you know, on the manufacturing side. So talk a little bit about that. And you know, you probably know about it and you understand the whole thing. And just give us in layman's terms, you know, is a trade deficit bad? Is it good? Or does it depend on the situation?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something, it's a piece of information that in and of itself can't really be analyzed. You need the context and you need the full picture around it. I am somebody who believes in free market capitalism. I'm somebody who believes in having resources be at their highest and best use. And certainly we are the leader in so many different things. And you mentioned the entire service economy, which is really, you know, the big share of our economy and the fastest growing part of our economy. And as you look at job reports, usually one of the top, if not the top place where we're seeing job growth, you know, that's obviously very important that we're not necessarily making everything, but the intellectual property and the marketing and the overall management is being done here. So we have to look at that in context. I certainly believe that the opportunity for us in markets like China, instead of viewing them as just an adversary, but looking at it as an opportunity, the opportunity to partner with them eventually and get them to open up, you know, that opportunity to us and to start exporting there is just tremendous. And so I think that getting caught up in these, you know, small little things and tariffs here and tariffs there doesn't make a lot of sense. At the end of the day, a tariff is a tax. We've just discussed that we can't tax our way into prosperity, so it doesn't work on the tariff side either. I don't like the government picking winners and losers, but if they're going to do it, I'd rather see it via incentives, like we saw with tax reform, or, you know, additional incentives, perhaps for certain industries, if we think that they're national security interests, versus a tariff. I think that, you know, that's what the other countries are doing in terms of subsidies and the like. So I'd rather see it done in a positive incentive-driven manner than in a tax-driven manner. But the challenging thing with President Trump is that you never really know where his position ultimately is. And so, you know, from day one, it was a question of, you know, is this a negotiating point? Is this art of the deal? And, you know, where on the spectrum do we land? And his methods are certainly unconventional. His communication is unconventional. But a lot of times, despite all of the brain damage along the way, the outcome ends up being really great. And so I think that on something like the tariffs, I'm going to sort of wait and see where we actually end up versus getting completely hysterical about them today.
But you don't have to get hysterical to sit there and say tariffs, like you said, tariffs are a tax.
Yeah.
Basically what he's doing is he's saying, you know, we're going to tax your imports 25% of steel. You know, I think the Commerce Department really stretched on the whole national security issue that allowed him to do this. And what I think what frustrates me is, like, you have all these Republicans saying this is wrong. 100 members of the House wrote him a letter saying you shouldn't do this. And everyone is saying this is a mistake. And Ted Cruz on TV saying this is a mistake and we shouldn't do this and this is wrong. And then John Cornyn comes out and says, yeah, we're probably not going to do anything about it, though. It's like, I mean, if it's wrong.
But he's already moved the position. So he says that. And he does it anyway, but then all of a sudden it starts getting repealed. So first it's like, no, Canada and Mexico, you guys, you're opted out. So now they're no longer part of this. Then South Korea delivers us a letter and says, hey, you know, based on this, can we get out of it? And like, yeah, probably you can get out of it. So they'll probably get out of it. By the time we're done with this, it kind of seems like everyone's going to get out of it. So he'll say that he was, you know, tough and did these things for the steelworkers. But at the end of the day, there probably won't be any tariffs. And I think that's where that whole complicated, weird approach that he has to negotiating ends up. And so I don't disagree with you. I agree with you. But at the same time, I'm not so sure that when we look at it and it's said and done, that there's going to be a tax or a tariff on anybody of any consequence.
Yeah. You know, we'll find out. Everybody's been exempted. And it's like, Greenland is going to pay the 25%.
You know, right, exactly.
That's probably.
Yeah, penguins in Antarctica who don't send us any steel. You guys, we're getting tough on you, and you guys are going to carry the tariff.
That is kind of funny. I think about it. Everyone's going to get exempted from it, and everyone will be like, okay, yeah, we're fine with the tariffs because nobody's actually paying it.
Right, exactly. the phantom tariff.
So, all right. So stepping outside of the. Purely the political slash business world, just straight politics on this here for just a minute or two. You probably saw the race, the special election in Pennsylvania last night. It looks like Connor Lamb may actually eke out a win, a couple hundred votes in a very, very strong Republican district. You know, Trump won it by 20 points. Murphy, who was there, you know, ran unopposed in 2016. He ran unopposed in 2014. And now you may have a Democrat that may actually represent that district, which ironically won't be there. It's a district that's going away when Democrats, you know, when they redraw all the districts. But it is a win. Do you? There are a lot of people. I'm one of them. I am one of the people who thinks that the GOP is probably going to lose the House. I don't think they're going to lose the Senate. The Democrats just have too many seats they have to defend there. But, you know, in the House, they've only got to flip 24, 25 seats, and they may be able to do that on the margins. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's certainly a possibility. I mean, one thing about the Democrats is that they, A, have a really good ground game. So, you know, in terms of getting people out and getting people to buy into something, even if it doesn't make any sense, they're really good at doing that. And I think that that's a challenge. The other thing is that, like, the interesting thing being in the center and being able to sort of semi-objectively look at both parties is that the Republicans have sort of this weird infighting going on where everybody's standing on principle. And so they'll, like, just eat each other. They'll have no problem with that. Where the Democrats will fall in line for the quote unquote good of the party. And so I think that with those dynamics going on, there is a very realistic possibility that, you know, when it's all said and done, the Democrats could take the House.
Yeah. All right. And so now let's also talk about going back to kind of the business aspect of it, just like switching gears very quickly from politics back to this. So Gary Cohn resigned his position as Trump's economic advisor, which I think was a bad loss for the administration. I thought Gary Cohn was was great to have on for Trump to have on his team. But, you know, I think he surprised some people by naming Larry Kudlow as his new economic advisor. I saw you tweet congratulations to Larry. I don't know if you know him, but what do you think about that choice?
Okay, so now I'm going to be the ultimate most horrible person once again going, oh, I know Larry. So I was with CNBC for 4 years, and one of my regular shows that I did was the Kudlow Report, which was a very interesting mix of business and politics. So I've known Larry for a long time. And what's very interesting about Larry is that his catchphrase is free market capitalism is the best path to prosperity. And so he really is one of the original champions of this era of free market capitalism. And as somebody who is going to be against things like tariffs, the same thing that seemed to get Gary Cohn into trouble. So it's interesting. I think that Larry has a big job in front of him. I think that Larry earnestly believes that he can shape the president's mind and direction. I'm not sure that anybody can do that, but I appreciate that Larry is going to give it a good old college try. And he certainly has a lot of experience. You know, one of the interesting things that I've seen, there's so many people who aren't familiar with Larry, and people think that he was just picked because he's on television, not realizing that he was in the OMB office as a associate or assistant economic director under Reagan, and that he was also an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. So he certainly has the experience and the chops, both from the economy side, you know, being under the Reagan administration. He's got a lot of experience. I am very supportive of his ideas and his approach. And all I can say is I hope that the president will listen and incorporate some of the guidance that he has. He's been very instrumental in, you know, some of the tax cuts that we did finally get through. So I think he's a great, great choice. He's a great person. And we'll keep my fingers crossed that he can bend the president's ear enough to keep that on course.
Yeah, I think that's, you make a good point, is that a lot of people just think that he's a television personality. Right. And it's like, no, he's got a long history of, yes, actually being, you know, getting his hands dirty in this type of work. So it's, you know, he knows all this stuff, and, you know, former Democrat as, you know, as well. In fact, you know, he's a Democrat up until probably the late 70s, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. So I think it's a good choice as well. I think Larry and the president are about the same age, 70, 71. You know, Larry's also, he's a New Jersey guy. So he, you know, that Northeastern kind of thing. And so there's that vibe going on.
He wears great suits. They have a lot in common.
Yes. Yes. Larry's a very sharp dresser. That's for damn sure. You know, he's got the whole Gordon Gekko look down, you know, to a T.
Totally.
So, yeah, I know. I remember used to watching Larry on you know, shows like, gosh, this goes back to the early 90s and Crossfire and everything like that, you know, and the suspenders were the big thing at that time. So, yeah, so I have fond memories of listening to him talking about the economy, talking about tax cuts, especially when he wrote for National Review. There was always some good stuff there. I think this is not, you know, this is not just a reality show president picking a television host. He's actually got a guy who's got some chops. So I think that's
some
great
experience and also some really good resources. You know, he's really close with Art Laffer, and he's really close with a number of different people, you know, economists, politicians, you know, people who really have a lot to add. So I think he'll be a good way to be able to funnel and, you know, test out some things as well and add them in with his own convictions and be able to present them back. So really, really solid choice.
All right. So we're gonna start wrapping up here. I want to give you a chance to talk about something that you have, a program that you have. It's called Future File, and kind of go ahead and talk about what that is and what that's all about.
So of the like 1.5 million things that I tend to do, my most important project that I'm working on right now is a legacy planning and wishes organization product that is available currently for sale called Future File. And you can check it out at futurefile.com. But the background on it is that I've had this sort of lifetime original movie sort of life. I've had a lot of really great things happen, but I've had a lot of really terrible things happen as well. And I've lost 4 loved ones. I had a boyfriend who was killed in a car accident my senior year of college. And then right after that, my mom was diagnosed with leukemia. She passed away the day after her 51st birthday. And then my stepmother got lung cancer and passed away at age 55. And at that point in time, my father came to my sister and I, and you know, he looked at us and said, hey, if something were to happen to me, I'm not sure you'd know exactly what to do or be able to find everything. So I'm going to start to give you stuff and I want you to put it in a file. And, you know, as 20-something-year-olds, we kind of rolled our eyes and said, yeah, whatever, Dad. And it took these pieces of paper and threw them in a file and didn't really think about it. But lo and behold, in 2013, my sister called me and my father was in a freak accident. And we had to go to the hospital. And she said, grab that file. And I did. And we had to make an end-of-life decision. And so we went through and found out what my dad's wishes were in those particular circumstances. And we carried out that decision. And he didn't make it. And then we had to do all the things that one has to do when you're the person in charge. And so, you know, everything from the burial to the services that went around with it to wrapping up the personal affairs. And by having this information together, we basically not only saved a lifetime of burden from carrying around, did we make the right decision? But we saved more than $10,000 tangible dollars because end-of-life costs are the third most expensive cost a family has in a lifetime behind a house and a car. And we also saved hundreds of hours trying to track down all of my dad's stuff and make sure that we had it all and then, you know, take care of it. So when we told people about what my dad had done for us, everyone kept saying like, oh, I need to do this for my parents, or I need to do this for my spouse, or I need to do this for my kids. And when we looked around, while there were people who maybe talked about wills or talked about trusts or powers of attorney, nobody had sort of put it all together. And certainly nobody was addressing things like social media passwords or Bitcoin wallets and PayPal accounts, or, you know, in the case of aging or dementia, things like, you know, caregivers and medical history and the like. So we put it together in the system, which we're special pricing for just $100 one-time fee. And basically you organize your wishes and information, and the output is this roadmap for your loved ones to follow, whether it's an aging issue like dementia or Alzheimer's or an accident, or if your loved one passes away, then you know what to do. You have access to everything, and it saves you that grief. It saves you the time, and it saves you the money in that time you need it most. So it's very important to me. It was a huge gift my father gave to me. We want to pass that gift on to as many other families as possible. So I would encourage you that if you check out Future File, you can even take the quiz to see if you're prepared. But if you're not prepared, do it now, because once that situation happens, it is too late. And as I said, it's $100 that will literally save you hundreds of hours and an immense amount of time.
Yeah, it's futurefile.com. And like Carol said, it's only $100. I'm looking at it right now. There's no like hidden thing where you're paying X amount and then paying another X amount and then paying another X amount. It's nothing like that. You know, the thing you brought up was interesting about social media. You know, a friend of mine recently passed away from cancer. And he ran a website, a political website that was a Ohio based political website. And there was a little bit of a struggle with his wife trying to find like passwords for his email or have that information all together to be able to transfer the website to somebody else who was going to take over and kind of run it. And so that's a perfect example. Like you mentioned that it's like email passwords, social media passwords, things of that nature. To have that information that's there, especially, you know, it's like if you want to do something. I remember like even my mother, she passed away in 2010. She had a Facebook account. I didn't have the password for that. And then it was kind of weird for a while when I would sit there and see, like, you know, like my mother's thing show up on my Facebook page. It was like on the side on the thing. It was like, it was a little, you know, weird just seeing that, you know, and, you know, if I had the password, I could have just went in, deactivated the account as it should have. But so that's an interesting thing. And that's just a small part of it.
Right. And also, if she had people that she knew that maybe she would have wanted for a period of time, you to put some sort of an announcement so that if they didn't see it in the local paper, they didn't say, hey, well, you know what happened? There's so many things. And now that we have these crazy digital footprints, not just online, but think about like what's on your computer, and what's on your smartphone, and what you want someone to see and what maybe you don't want someone to see. Taking care of all of that and the pre-planning is just, it's so important. I can't stress it enough.
All right. Well, yeah. So make sure you check that out. Also make sure you go to carolroth.com. You know, it's funny, Carol, your Twitter avatar and the picture that you have at your website, I have a similar tie. So we have like the same tie, which is kind of funny. So every time I see that picture of you in that tie, it's like, I have a similar tie to that. Same color, stripe.
I can't get rid of it because of that Muskets tree. And everybody knows me as the girl in the suit and the tie. So like, even though the picture is so old, it's like become so iconic.
Yeah.
That I just kind of feel like it's like a brand thing, like the Coca-Cola logo. It's not actually me. It's just kind of like a thing. You know? Yeah. You
can't go away with it now because everybody will be like, who's this person?
Yeah. Exactly.
Where'd the other one go? Carol, thanks so much for being on the Fifth Estate. It was great having you here.
Thanks, Jay. I really appreciate the opportunity and the opportunity to connect with your listeners.
Yeah, and you're a Cubs fan, right? You're a big Cubbies fan. You're looking forward to the start of the season.
We're diehard Blackhawks fans. We're Bears and Raiders fans. We're Bulls fans, and we're Cubs and White Sox fans. But I did go to Game 7 of the World Series in Cleveland, and I saw the Cubs make history, which was one of the highlights of my life.
Now that's something that we both have in common. I was at the World Series in 1996. I mean, now, of course, you know, the Yankees, so they had an 18-year drought at that point. Right, you're probably like, yeah, exactly. Big deal, pal.
My heart bleeds for you. That must have been a really difficult time.
But you know, it was funny. I was 8 years old when they had won the World Series prior to that. And so I was still kind of really young and not able to kind of get into it the way you do when you get a little bit older. So going there in 1996... I went for free. I didn't even pay for the tickets, which was great. And my brother and I went and we were there. And I have said this and I'll tell you and I'll tell people who are listening that I've been to, you know, heavy metal concerts, rock concerts, you know, AC/DC with the cannons going off. There was nothing as loud that I've heard ever than when Charlie Hayes caught that last out. And 60,000 people at the old Yankee Stadium just like erupted in like this scream that my ears were ringing the following day. It was that loud, but it was such an amazing moment. And for you to be there to see the Cubs do it, wow, that is really amazing.
Years, half the stadium was Cubs fans. We all became new best friends. And the hairs still stand up on my arms when I think about it. It was just
yeah,
like a special moment.
It is. It's like, it's the same thing. I'm sitting there and I'm thinking back to when I was there. And I remember, you know, Joe Girardi hitting this triple and the stadium just went out of its mind, and there's people that I saw that night that I'll remember for the rest of my life who I've never seen again. You know what I mean? Just people sitting in front of me and things of that nature. And it's like you remember these moments that you had, and like you've never seen them again. You probably never will, but it's like you'll never forget them. So that's
right. But you shared this special moment in time.
Yes. So that is a great moment. I'll have to sit there. You know, I don't know if you know Jim Swift from the Weekly Standard. He's a big Indians fan, so maybe I'll just go there and say, hey, you know, Jim, do you follow? Because she was there when the Cubs beat the Indians.
a great way to ingratiate yourself, Tim.
He'll like it. He's a good-natured, suffering Cleveland Indians fan. So it's one of those things.
I told all the Cleveland fans, who, by the way, aren't bitter at all, it wasn't their story. So it would have either been the Cubs won or the Cubs lost. Like, they did not factor into that decision at all. It was not their moment. So I do hope that they have their moment because it's a great city and they were very, very kind and gracious, but it just wasn't their story.
No, it wasn't. But they had their moment with LeBron and the basketball championship. So they finally got something there after a while. So, all right, Carol Roth, everyone. Again, check her out on Twitter at Carol J.S. Roth, and then go to carolroth.com. And also make sure you go to Future File and, you know, check out that program and look at what that can do for you to, you know, help you prepare for it's not a fun thing. But inevitably everyone's going to pass from this life. So it, you know, you have to make those preparations, and it's smart to do it. And so that looks like something that would be very helpful for people. So check that out. All right, Carol, thanks again. Hopefully we'll have you back at some point, right?
We'd love it.
All right, Jay. Okay. Have a good evening. And everyone, that is going to do it for this episode of the Fifth Estate. We will be back next week. We don't know who's going to be the guest, but we'll try and... We always have great guests. That's the best part about the show, you know, as we just had a great guest. You know, so we'll have another great guest at some point. But that's going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. We will see you next time on The Fifth Estate.